Welcome to the Speak Like a Leader podcast with John Bates.
Welcome to the show. With me today is David Zaretsky, and he's someone that I met recently. We had some very interesting conversations, and I wanted to get him on the show. He's the CEO and chief scientist and co-founder of Snips, which is an influencer network and platform, which we're going to talk about in just a minute. He's also an adjunct professor at Northwestern University, and he's at the Farley Center for Entrepreneurship, and he's also an adjunct professor at DePaul University College of Computing and Digital Media. And David, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thank you. It's really great to be here.
So, you know, one of the things that we're going to talk about is kind of AI in general, but we're going to leave that for a little bit later in our time together. One of the things, though, that brings that up is that you have co-founded this platform and influencer network called Snips, and you're also the CEO and chief scientist there, so you know how it works. And tell us a little bit about it. And as I understand it, you're leveraging AI there to make that whole thing better for both sides of that equation.
Yeah. And it's such an exciting area and such an exciting to talk about. And I wish I could talk about it all day. there's so many great things, in influencer marketing in general has really become such a big concept, especially over COVID. You know, when everybody was shopping online, and how do I communicate my brand to people if I can't get them into the retail stores? And so influencers really have, become this really big part of every sort of marketing strategy. I think I was just reading some latest statistics. They were saying, I think this year was supposed to top over $1 billion in marketing spends, and or maybe it's $3 billion, I think, this year, and maybe $4 billion next year. So there's a lot of really opportunities in the influencer marketing space. But the great thing about it is that from an entrepreneurial perspective, anybody can become an influencer. We're all influential amongst our peers or communities. And from our perspective, you know, when we first started out Snips, we didn't really look at things like followers as the metric that identified people as influential. We looked at things like, you know, can I drive my audience, my friends, my colleagues to take some measurable action, right? Mm-hmm. And that action is, you know, really dependent on whatever the brand is looking for, whatever you're looking to do. Can I get them to listen to my podcast? Can I get them to watch a video? Can I get them to purchase? There are many different things. But scaling that is obviously, you know, interesting to brands. But from really being influential, you don't need to have a million followers to start a career as an influencer. You can really start from the get-go. And so Snips, we started out as really a platform for influencers. We develop a whole suite of tools that allow influencers to create and share content, schedule their posts, engage with their audience, measure, gain, you know, a lot of insights, not just, you know, what I call the vanity metrics on social media, but also a lot of clicks, psychographic and demographic information about their audience. And then also being able to measure that all the way through conversions and sales.
Yeah.
And so now you have a full platform. You have all the analytics, all the data that you need to be able to take that to a brand and show them, hey, I'm able to really move the needle for your brand at whatever scale. And then on the brand side, we have a whole end-to-end platform for working with influencers and managing the whole process. But our key focus has always been since day one being a performance-driven. And so we developed these various different campaign platforms that allow you to work with influencers on different performance models, whether it's to drive sales, drive click-throughs, drive contest entries, viewability, and all these things that you're allowed to measure now and track that again from social media all the way through the sales and do that automatically. So it's very streamlined, and it's something very unique in the influencer marketing space that we're doing that really sets us apart from others. But as it kind of relates to AI, you know, we do a lot in terms of on both sides, both with the influencers and the brands. And as far as fraud detection is one of the biggest hurdles that brands are facing today. You know, there's a lot of fake accounts, fake engagements on social media, and those are really closed systems. Brands don't have a lot of insight into how, you know, how can you identify if, you know, somebody is using, you know, these Instagram pods, Facebook groups, and other means to inflate your traffic, inflate your likes, inflate your, you know, these like for likes and things like that. We took a very active approach by introducing real-time fraud protection. This is just one example of how we're leveraging AI to be able to eliminate over 99% of non-human traffic from all of our performance campaigns, right? A normal brand would not be able to do this through a Facebook or Instagram because they have no visibility into that traffic. We can do that in real time through the engagement. So these are just some examples. And we also leverage all of the data that we're consuming from the outside, such as aggregating news and music content and turning that into a sort of opportunities to automatically recognize elements of you know, what are people talking about in real time. If you and I are having a conversation, and the other day we were talking about Blue Origin, right? Yeah. And it's a fascinating week just in the AI space to have this, you know, shuttle take, you know, the automatically, right, autonomously take these people into the atmosphere and then back down and land with pinpoint accuracy, right? You couldn't do that with AI, right? We were talking about that. And if I were to just say Blue Origin in a social media post, how do we know what Blue Origin is? You know, maybe it's a new type of drink. Maybe it's a car. I don't know. Right. So how do we know what the context is? And through SNPs, through our AI platform, we're able to consume all of the news content from all over. And then using natural language processing, we can start to identify in real time, what are people talking about? What's the context and things like that. And that, that really opens up the door for analysis and these are just some of the interesting things that we're doing with respect to AI and how we're trying to improve the communications and tools that are available to both brands and influencers.
So what do you think are some of the you know, because I think that when you say influencer marketing, I think stuff comes up for people. Some people think awesome, some people maybe less awesome, right? I mean, it's a mixed bag like life. What are some of the things that you've noticed out of your work with influencers that you think could be good for leaders to know or for leaders to think about? Is there anything like that for you?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, business leaders themselves are highly influential. And there's a whole other, you know, B2B influencer, you know, side of things where you know, brands are looking for prominent leaders to talk about, you know, best use cases, especially when it comes to things like AI, right? And new concepts, new ideas. How do I integrate this with my brand? What are things I should be thinking about? And, you know, in my class that, I have this class that I put together at Northwestern at the Farley Center, which is, it's called Newvention AI Analytics, and it focuses on, students building a company around AI. And we bring in thought leaders from all different areas to talk about, you know, how do I think about AI and AI ethics and business strategy, and how do I think about technology and all the legal ramifications of AI, you know, 2, 5, 10 years down the line, right? And so each of these business leaders themselves, you know, are really learning to, you know, share their knowledge and their wealth of knowledge to these other audiences, and you really can use that as a way of building your own brand, learning to communicate and being a more thoughtful leader, and taking that message to social media and creating really just a great community, right? You know, people want to listen and share, understand your own insights and experiences.
Yeah.
And so,
By the way, David, I neglected to say this, but if you want to find David, here's the easiest, quickest way. Go to linkedin.com/in/David Zaretsky, DavidZaretsky. So linkedin.com/in/David Zaretsky. So sorry to interrupt you there, David, but I want to make sure people got that so they could go find you if they wanted to.
Thank you.
So business leaders, I mean, for them to think of themselves and to really take it on like they're influencers is certainly one great thing we can learn.
Yeah. And it doesn't take a lot of effort to do that.
Yeah.
Right. It's a few posts, it's sharing content, adding their own, you know, insights, their own understandings, their own experiences to their posts.
Yeah.
And from that, it really just kind of evolves over time.
Well, you know, one of the things that I've been thinking about because of the work that I do is the fact that if you as a leader have you've got a lot of experiences, right? Most leaders have a lot of experience. And yet if you don't have well-chosen, well-crafted, well-told stories about that experience, then its value is vastly diminished because no one else is benefiting from those stories and from that experience because they're locked up inside my head as a leader. I haven't taken the time to really get some good stories to tell about all that experience. And, you know, so I'm always trying to remind people that storytelling is just sharing your experience. And it's very, very important. It's a way to leverage that experience and make it vastly more valuable than if it's just riding around by itself in your head. But I think what I'm hearing and what you say is that there's another level to that. It's not just telling those stories here to the people right in front of you or your team or whatever. You could take those stories out to social media and the leverage that's available for those stories and that experience and the difference that your experience makes in that venue just is massively multiplied.
Yeah, right. Exactly. There's so much more potential once you can broadcast that message to a larger audience, right? It's mm-hmm. and there's different strategies of how to do that. I don't want to, you know, if you just put out a post, you're not going to automatically get a million followers, right?
Sure, of course.
So there's work involved there. But, from the business leadership sort of standpoint where you come from, getting out there and speaking, getting on podcasts, engaging with people, going to conferences and things like these are all great ways to kind of build your own brand. And so certainly encourage all of that. But, I think that there's, from just I think business leaders in general should always consider ways in which they can, get their voice out because they have these unique voices and people really want to learn from the top of the top people out there, right?
Yeah.
And the CMOs, the CEOs, CTOs, all the CIOs, right? All of the struggles that they're facing, smaller businesses, other people are they need to learn from these people. This is not something you're taught in school. Try to. Right. But a lot of the stuff you learn on the job and, cybersecurity is a huge issue right now. Right.
Oh, boy.
So, what are CIOs thinking about and CTO in terms of securing an infrastructure? And we had this blackout the other day, right. That took down a bunch of the top websites from, I think it was Alchemy. That goofed up and put out some some software update and knocked out all these big companies, all their networks and stuff, right? What happens in those situations? How do we prepare for the inevitable catastrophe, right?
Mm-hmm.
So people need to learn. They need to be aware of these things, and thought leaders who've experienced these things can become, leaders and thought leaders and influencers who can help others and teach them how to prepare. Right.
Yeah. Well, and you remind me of one of the things that I think I need to keep reminding people of, which is the fact that, a lot of people will that I encounter think that, you know, they, well, you know, John, I mean, you've got exciting stories. You trained the astronauts, you ran away with a rock band. I mean, you have exciting stories. I don't have any exciting stories. Who wants to hear what I have to say? Well, here's a few things about that. Like, first of all, if something happened in your life and you still remember it at this age, probably something, it was probably significant somehow, and you learned some lesson. And if you're willing to go look into that thing, that experience that you still remember, because think of all the experiences that you don't even remember. But if that one stands out as one you remember, there is something valuable in that for you. And guess what? I'm a human being too. If you share that well, it would be valuable for me too. And what you just said, David, is really, really big, because people don't want to share what struggles they're going through, right? Like, we all get kind of drawn towards sharing the awesome stuff, right? Look at social media. All people post up there is, oh, look, I'm on vacation. You know, it's like, but the real value comes from hearing about the difficult times and hearing what it is that you're struggling with right now. And what are your, you know, what is your, what's your mental model for this? How are you dealing with it? What do you think? You know, maybe engage people in a conversation. That's the really valuable content from what I've seen.
Would you know, absolutely. I would say that, you know, a really real successful entrepreneurs don't learn from success. They learn from failure.
Yeah. Right.
I'm an entrepreneur. I think every entrepreneur out there who's kind of gone through this journey, has really, you know, had their ups and downs, and, they've learned how to create, and myself, right. I've learned how to create processes to manage things so I don't have to worry about them all day and night. And I could teach those processes to other people. If you're starting your business, here are some things that you can do to automate, right? And so, you know, a lot of these things will be on autopilot and you don't have to think about them, right? If something goes down, I get an instant alert. Right. Mm-hmm. If something goes down, I can immediately go and fix it. I don't have to wait for a customer to complain. So those are, you know, these are the things that every small business or medium business or even an entrepreneur or startup needs to know about. And business leaders have so much wealth of knowledge, not just technical and business knowledge, but also how they balance their life and business. And you know, what struggles they've had personally and stuff like that. I think a lot of entrepreneurs just kind of, they don't even think about it. It's not even on their radar. Right? Right. What do you do when you got a family and you have to start a business? Right. So
absolutely.
Right. That mentorship, I think, is so important.
Yeah. At SNPs, you guys are applying artificial intelligence. And so let's go to a more general discussion about that. And I understand that there are multiple kinds of artificial intelligence. And from our conversation, I think that you're not ultra worried right now that Terminator-style artificial intelligence is going to take us out anytime soon. I do tend to be a little more worried on that front, although I get it's not going to happen like tomorrow. I would love to understand your perspective on, you know, how do you break down the different types of artificial intelligence and what's actually, you know, and I think machine learning gets tossed in with artificial intelligence that may be warranted or not at times, I suppose. So do you want to just decode that world for us a little bit?
Sure.
And then let me throw my biggest artificial intelligence complaint at you, maybe.
Well, so I've been doing AI for well over 2 decades. I actually started out back in when I was doing research in my master's and PhD research. We were implementing elements of AI. There's a lot of different parts of AI, right? You can get into computer vision, and there's machine learning is just one type of AI. There's regression. There's, you know, so there's a lot of different elements. And I can tell you a story. You know, when I was in just finishing up, I think it was my undergraduate, That's right. I just graduated. I was working at Case New Holland, which is a, you know, they build agricultural equipment, you know, diggers and other stuff.
Yeah.
And I was working on some of the first autonomous tractors.
Wow.
Working in the advanced technology department, we built out this tractor in conjunction with University of Illinois, one of the professors there. And this tractor was able to plow the fields automatically for you. We used GPS. We were actually able to get close to centimeter accuracy. Wow. There was no room for error when you're plowing your fields.
Yeah.
If the tractor goes veers off to the left, you've destroyed all your crops, right?
Yeah.
So we were doing autonomous vehicles. This is back in 2000.
Wow. Right?
So this is way before. Now we have, you know, companies who are trying to build out, you know, autonomous cars on the highway and stuff, right? But these are, you know, using many different elements of AI. Part of it is, you know, and they're not just AI. There's other aspects to it as well. But we're using computer vision. We're using, you know, other things to identify potential objects and things in the way, and so on and so forth. So object recognition. But to nowadays, when we kind of think of AI, I think probably the most prominent, there's three key areas. There's obviously a lot of areas, but the three key areas is in supervised learning, unsupervised learning, and reinforcement learning. Reinforcement learning is not studied as much these days in class. Reinforcement learning is typically you learn as you go. So a classic example would be you put a robot on the room, and every time it hits the wall, it gets some negative feedback. It's that reinforcement, and it starts to learn the boundaries of
yeah, like a Roomba maybe or something.
Right, exactly, right. You're not giving it a map in advance. It's just going out and discovering. When I was working on the tractor, these autonomous tractors, we plotted the map first. So we took it through the map, and so it had the original map, and then the idea was to go back along the map, but also using computer vision to keep it from veering off into the crops, right?
Mm.
So that was then one element. The unsupervised learning gets into, probably the more popular would be clustering. And that's when you just have a bunch of data points and you're trying to find correlations between different data points. Examples of that might be, you know, where we're all sitting in a park, everybody's sitting in the park using their phones, and you know, maybe some people are watching videos and some people are watching or reading the news. And so if we can identify all the people who are watching the videos, we can sort of cluster them together. These are video watchers, and then we can identify people who are watching the news. Those are news readers, right?
Yeah.
And so the clustering is just taking in all this information, just finding correlations between them. And then the ones that are studied probably the most in class is going to be the classification, which is the supervised learning. And that, the idea there is that we're taking historical data and we are learning from the historical data and then using that to predict new data or given some new input, we want to predict the output for that. And a couple of models, the regression is a classic example. That's where you have numerical input and you're trying to predict a numerical output.
Mm-hmm.
So if I have a history of prices for the homes that are sold in my neighborhood, and I want to predict, you know, given, you know, the number of rooms, number of bathrooms and stuff, I want to predict what the sale price is going to be, right? So that would be a regression model.
Okay.
And then we have the classification model, which is kind of where all the image processing comes in. So this is where you have facial recognition, right? So I get 100,000 images of different people, and I'm trying to classify the gender, age, race, and things like that, right?
Uh-huh.
And so you're kind of learning from, and that could be applied to text as well and others. So those are sort of the three key areas, right, that we typically study or are applying mostly these days. Again, there's a lot of other areas, but
yeah.
So getting back to your original question, which was the Terminator days, right?
Yeah.
The end of the world. I think Hollywood has done a really great job of romanticizing this idea of AI and sentient beings that are going to take over the shows like Westworld and stuff like that. I think we're many, many years off from that. I think we're still many years off from actually adopting, you know, these autonomous vehicles from taking us everywhere automatically. We still got some time from that. But I think there's a misnomer in AI that AI is this sort of evil thing that is being used to manipulate people and stuff. And really what it is, it's another way of just, you know, solving problems or identifying patterns in data. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just like, you know, and I see this as being, you know, sort of the next evolution in education, kind of just like if I were to get a degree in computer science or computer engineering, you might take some core classes in network, or compilers or operating systems, you'll likely have a machine learning, core class because it's just like, you know, physics and algebra and stuff. If you're learning equations and ways of solving problems that normally would take hours, days, years to solve, we can now solve those problems in much less time, right? In fractions. Or you solve it once, and now I can apply that to solve new problems in fractions of a second, right? Nanoseconds. And so there's a lot of interest that is built up around this because it really changes how quickly we can evolve our technology and businesses and things like that by identifying opportunities for success or opportunities to prevent catastrophe. Example of that is I had a company that I was working for where we were working with NASA and the DOD to our technology was lifing engines and transmissions for helicopters, commercial and military aircraft. And the idea was that, you know, you and I, if we were to drive the same car, right, I might be a more aggressive driver than you. You know, the dealer says, bring back the car after 5,000 miles for the first upgrade, right? But I might, if I'm more aggressive, I might stretch the boundaries of, you know, how soon you should take it in for maintenance, right?
Yeah.
The same
yeah.
thing with airplanes and helicopters, especially in the military.
Yeah.
If you go into, a climate where there's high altitude or you have... Or
like you're landing in the Middle East where there's lots of sand.
Yeah, right. So all of those things have effects on the engine maintenance. And so if you can detect problems early, you can bring it down for maintenance earlier and avoid catastrophic damages. We've all heard, you know, news articles about, unfortunately, planes who have just crashed or had other issues during flight. They didn't catch certain issues. So we were working on that. And those types of models in AI are great. They're helpful. They help us prevent and avoid catastrophic damage, right? Not all AI is bad. I think where AI gets into a murky issue is when we start to apply that to humans.
Mm.
When we're trying to get into personal identifiable information, PII, right? And when we're using AI to predict your purchase behavior or, you know, where certain companies might be using it to manipulate people into, you know, whether it's purchasing or trying to sell their data or whatever that is, right? I want to differentiate those two because I think they're important. In the general sense, AI from a business and technology standpoint does amazing stuff, it's the new frontier in terms of technology. It's going to really help evolve our technology and catapult those. At the same time, I think, you know, and this is probably a wider discussion is how do we avoid these issues, whether it's bias or selling or creating data around people's personal information that can then be used for, negative opportunities or to do other things that are maybe are not good for society.
Yeah. So, I mean, so, you know, the upside of AI is pretty obvious, and we wouldn't be pursuing it with such vigor if there weren't a big upside. And, you know, General Electric has a digital twin for every one of the engines that they put onto airplanes. They're running a digital twin all the time. So that, and when, if that digital twin, you know, they can see the wear and everything by simulating what the actual engine's going through. And so just like you said, they can pull that off for early maintenance if it seems like that's going to be warranted, or they can let it go a lot longer than they thought they could because it's being, you know, it's not being worn as quickly. However, you know, the other area of AI that you just mentioned, I mean, I think probably many of the people listening have seen the movie The Social Dilemma. And that's certainly my biggest complaint, is that we took, I mean, and I guess it's not even a highly sophisticated AI. It might just, like, you know the terms better than I do, but we did pay some of our most talented computer scientists absolutely ridiculous salaries for the last, you know, 10 plus years to create our quote unquote artificial intelligence, whose end result has been to just absolutely magnify our differences and divide us and show us the most, you know, the most controversial, extreme content that leans in whatever direction we might have a slight lean in. And I just think that is, you know, I've said more than once, and I do actually believe it, if we don't solve the social dilemma, if you will, that got posed in that movie, I don't think we're going to solve another major problem on Earth as a species.
Yeah. You break up such a great point there. So, you know, there's kind of two things I would say to that. One is that and as an educator myself, and I teach AI and machine learning and more so at a nano level, so at the scale of circuits and things like that as well.
Uh-huh.
And so I see it from many different perspectives, but the interest in learning AI has really exploded computer science and computer science degrees. So, in the long term, I don't see social media companies first and foremost capitalizing on all the AI people out there. There's going to be a lot of AI folks who are going to be studying this stuff from, you know, maybe even in high school.
Yeah, right.
You know,
right.
I've talked to some brilliant kids in high school who are starting to learn this stuff. So it's, I think it's not as sort of science fiction-y as it sounds. It's really, you know, just learning another discipline. And it's not that difficult really to apply these types of technologies. So you're going to start finding a lot more machine learning, AI, computer science experts that are going to be all over. So I think the opportunities to bring them and creating more diversity and so on is going to be, first and foremost, I think we'll be seeing a lot of that. The second part to that is, you know, how many of these social media companies have utilized, and not just social media, but, you know, obviously with Google and others as well, right? How they do, you know, track audiences. They can know everything that you're looking at, what you're reading, what you're viewing. They're even looking at every video, and frame by frame, they can analyze, you know, the videos, what's in the videos, the topics and stuff like that. So they really know every ounce of detail about what your interests are, maybe even more so than the way you do.
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think that's an easy argument to make.
Right. And you know, Gen Z kids have become more so, I think, open about data. It's not really top of mind. I think it's just our generation has been a lot more, you know, has been more cautious about it.
Sure.
I don't know if that's good or bad, but I think that people have become sort of, you know, left to just appreciate that, you know, these are great platforms that have purpose. And as part of that, they also offer services to brands to advertise to me, and I don't click on the banner ad, so why do I care?
Right.
So some people are just, they're just okay with it. They don't mind. And the other flip side of it is that there are people who do mind. And I think that those people should voice their concerns, and we should have ethics and ways in which we can control the use of our data, how it's being used, and certainly how opening up for more competition with these other platforms so they don't dominate hold the reins on not just the data, but also our lives and what we can see, what we can't see, and controlling that information, I think, is really important.
Yeah. Boy, amen. So from your perspective, I mean, getting all the way down to the nano of artificial intelligence, let's just say that I'm an entrepreneur, or I'm running a large organization or a medium organization or something. What are some of the things that you think people should keep their eyes on the horizon for? Like, what, you know, what's coming, and what do I need to think of as a business leader in terms of AI and what's going on?
Well, there are, I would say that there's also certain adjacent technologies that are also popping up that are kind of interesting to think about as well beyond AI. Now, obviously, computers are getting faster. We're getting, you know, laptops with multiple cores and stuff, so you can take advantage of it. Yeah. But one of the things that's really interesting is that if you look at the latest M1 chip by Apple, right, which is now in all the laptops and the iPads and probably iPhones, I think, as well. They're no longer these single, you know, or multi-core CPUs. Now what you see are these system-on-chip technologies that include accelerators, right? What are accelerators? They're basically hardware components within the M1 chip that we can offload some certain types of computations to. For example, if you were doing video games, if you're running a video game, a lot of the graphics processing, once upon a time, we used to have what are called graphics cards that you used to put in your...
I remember, yeah.
Right?
They were expensive.
Yes, and those were essentially graphics accelerators, right? Now they're built into the chips. And we have these GPUs, the general purpose processing units, right, or graphics processing units that allow us to accelerate those. And they're tightly coupled to the CPU, so we can offload those instructions to the GPU. What Apple has done now is that beyond the GPUs, now we have machine learning accelerators and neural accelerators and other components there that allow us to now take advantage of machine learning applications and offloading those to these systems. Now, the question is, how do I take advantage of those accelerators, right? Normally, if you're coding, if I just code something up, it's going to put it onto the CPU. If I wanted to take advantage of the GPU, you'd have to insert certain instructions, to offload those to the GPU, right? And so now we need to reimagine how we're coding to take advantage of these new system-on-chip accelerators, right? Yeah. So that's changing the dynamics, and that goes into everything from computer software to apps that are running on your phone to anything else, right? We need to be able to take advantage of those hardware accelerators. That's just one element of where things are going. The second is, quantum computing is a big conversation these days, and that's a whole other conversation. But
that's a very interesting conversation. Wow.
Yeah, and as exciting as it is, it also opens up a plethora of problems, right? Because we have all of these, hashing schemes and algorithms that we've used for encoding passwords and stuff like that, that are typically unbreakable using a brute force method. It would take so many years to compute that it's not worth the time and power. But now comes things like quantum computing, and now you have potentially the capability of cracking these codes in a matter of seconds.
Yeah.
So it changes how we think about hashing password protection and other things, right? Brute force is no longer, you know, something that can take a millennia. It can be done in fractions of a second. And so now you have a handful of companies who have access to this type of technology, right? It's not everybody. There's going to be, you know, an IBM and a Google and so on. And so now, you know, who has access to that type of technology, and what is it used for? And so it's going to open up another Pandora's box, you know. And we're not there yet with, you know, it's still sort of in its infancy, but, you know, you can imagine in the next 5 to 10 years, they'll have some pretty big advances. And so cybersecurity is going to be a huge issue. By the time you've even recognized that there was a hack, it's already been done and all the data is taken from you. So it's going to be, well, I think I encourage people to start reading a little bit about what quantum computing is and capabilities and how it's been evolving so quickly, what the capabilities will be. And because those will definitely play a role, I think, in not just in cybersecurity, but certainly in terms of business opportunities, right? To be able to quantify lots of data and being able to process that in fractions of a second to get instantaneous, answers to problems, stock markets, other things like that, right? So it's exciting, but also kind of scary.
I mean, maybe quantum computing driven by, you know, sentient humans is maybe the more immediate fear, right? Like if bad actors get quantum computing, like there's just zero security for anyone anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, to house that kind of system is quite a feat.
We
would be able to put it into a little module in a brain and just walk around with it. I think, we're still many, many, many decades away from anything, I think, that could really do that. Humans today are still a part of the equation. And I still kind of believe that really AI is not there to replace humans. It's there as a tool to make us more efficient, you know, kind of just like once upon a time, we all rode bicycles and we walked around and then cars were invented. We still went to our jobs. We still did all the stuff. We just got there faster. You know, we're able to do a lot more, right? We're able to travel and visit cities and do things we could never do before. And I see AI is the same thing. AI is a tool to improve performance, to help us focus on the bigger picture. It's not going to make us dumber. What it's actually going to do is allow us to see more. It's going to give us opportunities to find opportunities and grow businesses and grow technology and enhance our lives and enhance our functionality and hopefully bring us closer together. If you can eliminate, you know, these sort of remedial tasks that you have to do all day and replace them with processes that can identify problems and stuff, I can sleep better at night. I can spend more time with my family instead of worrying about these things, right? So I look at AI from more of a partnership with humans as opposed to something that's out there to replace the human being.
Well, you know, I think that's a good way to look at it, because I think that it really, for the foreseeable future, it is probably less about AI and more about the people creating and designing and using AI. And, you know, it ends up coming down to it's our responsibility, just like freaking everything else that we want to avoid, you know? So I think that's a great message is AI, it's a partnership. And really at the end of the day, it's about what we choose to do with it and what we want to do with it. And, you know, I mean, clearly the whole ability to work from anywhere has been a mixed blessing. It does mean that we could take more time with our families, but do we end up actually using it for that? You know, is a good question. And I think that's a really, I think that's an interesting place to maybe sort of wrap it up, because I know we're coming up to the top of our time, but all these technologies, you know, they are arguably neutral and it ends up being what we do with them. And for so long, these things were supposed to save us time, but instead of using them to save us time, we just did more stuff. And I think it's interesting for us as human beings to start, because as these things become radically more powerful and make a radically more, a greater difference, we're really going to have some questions about what are we going to do here, you know? And I think it's an individual level, on a societal level, on a global level. But I think that's a good message, David, is, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in my class, my Nuvention AI class, we brought in speakers to talk about AI ethics. Uh-huh. And there is obviously a human responsibility. And I want to differentiate the stuff that we do in AI for, you know, technology and medicine and stuff like that. Those are one thing. But when we get into the human element, right, using human data, that's kind of where I think the AI ethics really plays a role. But sometimes we need that bias. Sometimes we need to, you know, for example, with COVID, right, with this new Delta variant, we need to identify who's the most susceptible to this. Yeah. And if we were to eliminate bias from the equation, how would we know that certain types of individuals or people who have had, you know, previous ailments and stuff like that are more susceptible, right? So sometimes bias is needed. And I think if we, you know, there's a lot of legislation going on, and there's a lot of communities trying to come together and putting out guidelines of what you can and can't do with AI, because they're afraid of, you know, what you're saying is that if somebody's going to manipulate and take over the world. And there's truth in that, but there's also truth in data. And we need to be able to see that data, whether you like it or not. Sometimes we need to see it first, and then what we do with that data is really something that, you know, individuals and society need to understand what can be done, what should be done, and what should be maybe put on the shelf.
Yeah, right.
And just left there for another time to discuss. I wish there was an easy answer to it, but I would say that, you know, my philosophy is there's truth in data, and we shouldn't be bashful about identifying that data wherever it leads us.
Yeah.
And then, you know, making sure that we've eliminated as much bias so that we don't apply that data to do harm to somebody, but only that we do something good to help people.
Yeah. Well, David, thanks very much for joining me and talking about this. And if you want to find David, he's at linkedin.com/in/David Zaretsky. And David, is there anything else that you'd like to say before we go? Is there anything I should have asked you, or anything just to wrap us up here?
No, I very much enjoyed the conversation. This is spectacular. I love, as you can imagine, I'm very passionate about AI and entrepreneurship and technology. And I appreciate the opportunity to be able to share my thoughts and insights, and I appreciate you having me.
It's my pleasure. And, you know, thanks for being so passionate, and thanks for letting your face know. You know what I mean? I think being passionate about something, I talk to a lot of people who are like, well, John, you know, I'm so passionate, but no one knows. I'm like, well, you got to tell your face. And sometimes it's a little scary to admit you're passionate about something. Someone might, you know, make fun of you, or then they got something on you or something. So I love talking to people who are passionate about what they're doing, David. And I appreciate you being here and sharing that passion with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right. And thank you for joining us. If you don't already get it, I have a weekly training that comes out every Sunday morning, and it is very, very short. And it is a great way to keep your head in the game of leadership and communication. And you can find it by going to executivespeakingsuccess.com and then signing up for the weekly mini training. Go to resources and you'll find a place to sign up for that. Thank you very, very much for joining us. And I will listen to you next time. This is John Bates, SpeakLikeALeader.show. Have a great, great week.
Thank you for joining the Speak Like a Leader podcast. Go be awesome.